Already on a hair trigger after the tense confrontation with the Freespacers, Earth's second line of defense, its first having been circumvented just by the location of Dagger Disc's arrival in-system, sprang into action the moment this new alert was given, but against a target of Dagger Disc's speed, there was little their automated tracking systems could do. The ship was moving faster than most known weapons of the day. Even an anti-starfighter weapon like a concussion missile topped out at around 200 megalites. Particle beams, plasma bursts, and phased energy discharges lashed the space all around Dagger Disc, but nothing touched the ship as she flashed through the geostationary satellite line and headed for low Earth orbit. Fighters scrambled from ground stations and several of the larger geosats, but they were too slow to catch up either. Before Earth Force Command even had a solid idea of the type of the intruder, Dagger Disc was carving an incandescent line through the upper atmosphere that was visible for thousands of miles around. Corwin, teeth gritted, held the ship steady as the atmospheric friction mounted, charring Dagger Disc's entire leading edge. Down here in the soup, he couldn't move nearly as fast, even with the throttles wide open, but he was still going so fast that if he wasn't careful, he would overshoot his mark, re-escape, and have to come around again. Cursing the necessity, he eased back to the atmospheric red line. He didn't bother with a deorbital curve plot, just powered through the wall of ionized resistance with sheer brute thrust and made for Worcester, knowing that Earth Force was closing the hole behind him and that getting out wouldn't be nearly as easy as getting in. They heard it before they saw it, the beleaguered little group of duelists crouching in the ruins of the wedge and waiting for the Corps to send their heavily armored enforcers in to finish the job. At first it sounded like a distant storm, then a freight train, then a howling gale. Then the glittering silver disc exploded over the ridge of Bancroft Hill, nearly stripping away the trees near the tower, and swooped across Park Avenue toward the quad. Repulsors wailing, thrusters roaring, it whirled like a car doing a J-turn as it settled down, its exhaust blast raking the parking lot and scattering enforcers and vehicles in its wake. The gear was barely down and locked before the ship slammed down, driving the three thick, stubby legs almost halfway down into the ground and causing huge gouts of grayish steam to shoot from the suspension overpressure vents.
"Dagger Disc!" Caitlin cried. "Corwin!" said Utina,
although how she knew she couldn't have said. The ship's windows were all gold-coated, impossible to see through from outside. She rose, pulling Amanda up with her. Dorothy tucked her newly acquired cat under one arm, then lifted Devlin, slinging him over her shoulder like a sack of oats. Krog hefted Liza Broadbank like a doll, and the duelists and their battered cargo ran down the steps and across the perimeter road toward the waiting ship. The portside boarding ramp slammed down on the emergency release again, sending brick chips and gouts of turf flying. Some of the enforcers recovered their wits and began firing, plasma discharges zipping through the air around the duelists. Dagger Disc's quad-mount belly turret tracked and opened fire, exploding several of the overturned personnel carriers and sending armored men and women flying. As the duelists ran, wounded toward the middle, Caitlin, Wakaba, and Sayanchi flanked the vulnerable side as best they could. Those with ranged weapons returned fire as best they could, but it wasn't much use, given the range. Tiny Robo's miniature missiles scattering amid the enforcers' ranks did seem to cause the black-armored men great consternation, though. One of the cooler-headed enforcers rose up on one knee in front of an overturned and burning armored car, steadied his rifle, and drew a bead on Dorothy. With a faint smirk, he depressed the trigger. Caitlin moved before she knew why, surging forward an extra half-step and bringing Kotetsu no Sasiaki to bear. A moment later, the plasma pulse burst free from the enforcer's weapon and streaked through the space between him and the fleeing duelists. Caitlin saw it coming as though it were nothing more than a thrown baseball, steadied herself, and smoothly, swiftly counter-struck, interposing her simple steel blade between the pulse of superheated gas and its intended target. There was a flash, and the enforcer tumbled backward, a smoking hole blown in his armored chest plate. A moment later, the duelists were inside Dagger Disc, pelting up the ramp even as it began to close. A moment after that, the ship rose on her screaming repulsors, pulling her already retracting gear free of the savage turf of the quad. Psycop Roger Tremaine, having just regained consciousness, stumbled out of the side door of Alden Memorial just as Corwin slammed open the throttles and exploded every piece of glass in every building facing the quad with the hot rod freighter's departing shockwave. Nearly deafened, Roger heard the discharges of the frustrated enforcer's weapons as tinny pops and the fading thunder of the Corellian ship's thrusters as a mere distant murmur. As if in a dream, he picked himself painfully up again and limped across the parking lot toward the enforcer squad's commander. A moment later, a pair of Earth Force MiG-230 Foxbat 3 atmospheric interceptors screamed past from the east in a futile attempt at catching the intruding ship. One of those Foxbats took a couple of shots at the fast-disappearing Dagger Disc with its blaster cannons, carving scarlet lines across the sky. They came nowhere near their intended target, but they did nearly hit a second ship which had just appeared out of nowhere over the ridgeline past which the fleeing ship had just disappeared. The newly arrived ship, a Cygnus Lambda-class executive shuttle thermocoated in a brilliant blue, returned the favor, lashing the Foxbat with what appeared to be ion cannon fire. Its onboard power systems crippled, the interceptor broke off pursuit, and made its very unhealthy-sounding way, pouring smoke to Worcester Regional Spaceport for an emergency landing, while its wingmate continued the chase. A moment later, the Lambda set down on the middle of the quad, neatly within the perimeter of Dagger Disc's landing gear pits, and its own ramp came down with somewhat more decorum. Roger looked at the logo emblazoned on the shuttlecraft's tall vertical fin and felt his heart sinking. A moment later, three figures jogged down the shuttle's ramp. Two of them were mechanoids, tall, spindly, snouty, Nemoidian battle droids, one beige, the other gray, both bearing the corporate logo of their owner on their plastrons. The beige one carried a blaster rifle, the gray a large and heavy-looking satellite uplink digicamera, its scarlet transmission-active light clearly illuminated. The battle droids flanked a human, a man about the same height as Roger and somewhat younger-looking, who wore gray fatigue pants, a black t-shirt with his company logo on it, and an orange utility vest. He had a Bajoran phaser pistol holstered at his side, data glasses, an intent expression, and bright blue hair in a ponytail that nearly reached his belt. "Psycor Regional Director Roger Tremaine," this man declared in a sharp voice that penetrated the thrumming shell of hollowness dominating Roger's hearing. "John Trussell, Network 23. We are live and direct in Worcester, Massachusetts, on the battle-ravaged campus of the Worcester Preparatory Institute. An Earth Force interceptor has just fired on our ship as we pursued our lawful course of reporting the news. Director Tremaine, 10 billion sentients want to know, what the hell is going on around here?" Roger's temper, very well frayed after the day he'd had, finally snapped. Snarling, even with the throbbing pain in his deeply wounded shoulder, the Psycop took a swing, an actual, old-fashioned, crude, physical swing, at the reporter. Truss stepped smoothly back out of range with a look of faintly mocking amusement. The beige battle droid took a step forward and bashed the Psycop in the chest with the butt of its blaster rifle, knocking him winded but not further injured to the ground. "Assault against a lawfully bonded journalist is in violation of the Earth Force Penal Code Section 114.59.3 Subsection 3 Paragraph A-14, the robot informed the Psycop in its monotonal voice. "This unit is authorized to meet force with force." "Now that you've gotten that out of your system, Director," said Trussell in an affable tone, as though nothing untoward had happened, "would you care to answer my question?" Roger raised himself up on his elbows, glared up at the reporter from the ground, and told him to take his pathetic, mundane carcass off Roger's crime scene and go do something anatomically impossible with himself. Network 23's ratings spiked another 19%. "Well, great," Janice Barlow grumbled as she stood against the sidewall of Higgins Labs and surveyed the scene. "I wonder what the hell that was all about." "Dunno," Edward replied, unconcerned. "It's a good sign for our team, though." "Why would you say that?" Edward strolled unconcernedly out from cover, straight to the side of a Utopia Planitia Danube-class runabout that was parked smack in the middle of the parking lot. Janice stifled a cry of frustrated concern, then noticed that it wasn't really necessary. With all the chaos the one ship's departure and the other's arrival had caused, nobody was looking that way. They were all looking at the quad. Janice hefted the duffel bag full of Durandal's logic core and jogged across to the side of the runabout. "In chaos," Edward observed sagely as she rascaled the hatch lock, "there is opportunity." Janice nodded, then zoomed in her cyber eye on the scene by the Blue Lambda's ramp. A smile spread across her face. "Give him hell, Truss," she thought. "I hope somebody tapes today's show. I want to see what this mess looked like from the outside." "Voila," said Edward as the hatch opened, and she sauntered inside, followed by an unconcerned Ein and a wary Janice. "Ooh," said Edward as she noted the interior appointments of the runabout. "Swanky. Must be an executive transport. Probably belongs to a bigwig. Regional director, at least." "Well," said Janice as she settled herself in the pilot's seat, "if you're gonna steal, you might as well steal nice." "Why, Director Tremaine?" Truss mused as Roger continued to glare at him and refused to answer his questions. "Someone seems to be stealing your personal shuttle." Roger whirled, then nearly passed out as his ravaged shoulder protested the sudden movement. Indeed, somebody did appear to be stealing his runabout. The Psycop reached for his comm badge, noticed it wasn't there, and snarled at Truss. "Well, you have a communications uplink. Notify air defense." Truss looked as if weighing it for a moment, then replied pleasantly, "Well, since you've been so very pleasant and cooperative this afternoon, no." Then he turned away, ignoring Roger utterly, and said into the camera his faithful battle droid held steady, "A fitting twist to cap a bizarre afternoon. Let's examine how this mess got started." Roger Tremaine nearly screamed, but given how his head was throbbing, that might have made it explode. So instead he turned, fuming, and limped toward the nearest trooper who looked like he had an intact communicator. Daggerdisk screamed out of Earth's atmosphere in much the same sort of hurry as she had arrived in, but the getting out was not as easy as the getting in had been. This time the Leo defense grid was ready, and the ship was flying toward it, not away. Blaster fire and plasma shots streaked across the speeding freighter's path and splashed against her overbuilt deflector shields as she maneuvered furiously, causing some of the satellites to shoot each other as they tried to track her. A stock YT-1312 freighter wouldn't have survived for a minute against this defense grid. It would have been ranged, bracketed, and exterminated inside the first 60 seconds of engagement. Luckily for Corwin and his friends, Daggerdisk was far from stock. The ship had seen many modifications and performance upgrades over her lifetime. Long before she fell into Corwin's father's hands, she had ceased to be anything resembling stock. In the hands of her current owner, though, Daggerdisk had not been so much transformed as apotheosized. It so happened that Griffin had helped to invent the extremely exciting, extremely dangerous sport of asteroid racing, back in the WDF's golden age. He'd long had the notion that a man with a Corellian 1300 series freighter space frame and a lot of time and money could make the ultimate asteroid racer out of it. Back in the day, though, he'd lacked the space frame and the time. In 2389, a hot rod YT-1312 had practically fallen into his lap and he'd finally had his chance. The new improved Daggerdisk that emerged from the shipyard complex in 2393 was, ton for ton, the most capable starship in the galaxy, with secrets that even some of the people who had helped her master remake her didn't know. But Corwin knew them, knew every inch of every system in her, and now he was counting on Daggerdisk's every advantage to get him and his precious passengers home again. This situation was a lot like an asteroid race, except more of the asteroids shot back, and Daggerdisk responded with an almost living enthusiasm, twisting and rolling between the defense satellite's arcs of fire. The twin quad turrets, one dorsal, one ventral, were auto-targeting, as were the strip-collimated omnidirectional phaser arrays built into the upper and lower hulls. The targeting computers weren't the most accurate things in the galaxy, but Corwin hadn't had time to recruit a crew of gunners, and he had his hands too full to take the pilot station controls of the main weapons just now. Instead, he flew the ship like a man possessed, his eyes almost closed, his big, knuckly hands steady on the control yoke as he made the freighter that was not a freighter dance her deadly dance with the Earth defense grid. The throttles were pinned to the firewall, military emergency power, and locked, the deflector recharge rate at minimum. This was a bit of a gamble, but Corwin felt the extra speed would be worth more than any amount of shielding power in an engagement like this, where the only object was to run the gauntlet and get away intact. Caitlin, Utena, and Dorothy entered as Corwin was ducking around a blaster set. Dagger Disc shuddered with what felt like a missile hit, almost throwing Kate against the flight engineer's panel. Only Dorothy's quick arm stopped her from a painful encounter with the reflex status display. Corwin dodged another missile set, blasted it with the twin cannons mounted in the cockpit module's chin, and then flicked an intercom key with his thumb. "Amanda, can you move?" he inquired. "Yes?" came Amanda Dessler's voice in his earpiece. She sounded weak and rattled, but firm. "Good," he said. "Get into one of the turrets and see if you can clear out some of these damn beam sats before they punch our ticket." "I'm on it," she replied. Corwin didn't turn around. Raising his voice slightly, he said, "Dorothy, take whichever one she doesn't." Without a word, Dorothy turned and left the cockpit again. A moment later, the green status light for the dorsal turret flicked from auto to manual on the master panel. A moment after that, the ventral turret followed suit. The blazing fire of the two quad turrets became a good bit more focused, scarlet light lashing out more precisely at the web of satellites. "How we doing?" Utena asked as she slid into the co-pilot's seat. "Decent," Corwin replied tersely, "as long as the shields hold up. We're not going to be able to fold out again, though. I don't have the codes for the fold computer, and I'm too busy to do the calculations in my head." "Can we help?" Utena inquired. "Not really," Corwin replied, dodging around a third-line beam sat. "Damn, it's crowded up here all of a sudden." An alarm wailed. Corwin glanced at the readout near it, then slapped the silencer. About to get more crowded, too. "Fighters at 5 and 7 o'clock low," Amanda Dessler's voice reported in his ear. "Yeah, I just noticed that," he replied. "Keep 'em busy." "Aye, aye, Captain." Corwin grinned just a tiny bit, pulled the ship's nose up, and aimed it at the open stars. "Come on, come on, come on," he muttered, watching the gravitic influence indicators flicker as they sped away from Earth amid a hail of blaster fire. Then, just as they were about to drop below the red safety line, they shot all the way to the top again. Corwin cursed. "Slag it, the rumors were true. They do have interdiction satellites." He leaned across in front of Utena, nudging her out of the way with his shoulder, in too much of a hurry to apologize, and did a few quick things to the sensor panel. The hollow display above it fed out a picture of a geodesic sphere pattern around a shadowy representation of Earth, with their own position marked by a flashing yellow triangle. Corwin noted the location of the nearest vertex of the sphere, locked the short-range navigation sensors on it, and then slung himself back into his own position. "Hang on," he said to all and sundry. "We're going back."
"What?"
Caitlin blurted. They streaked back into the thick of things, shuddering and bucking as the defense grid lashed at them. A squadron of very surprised Star Furies scattered as the silver Corellian ship flipped like a coin and drove through the middle of their attack formation. Corwin zeroed the chin guns in on the satellite indicated by the nav sensors, a large, oddly shaped one without any visible weapons emplacements, and fired. The blasts splashed away from deflectors much more powerful than those sported by the weapons satellites. Corwin cursed and peeled off, arching up and around the still regrouping Star Furies. Oh, I should have figured. He snarled as he sent Dagger Disc corkscrewing earthward in an effort to shed some of the defense grid's cannon fire. They've got capship-grade shields on those things. He considered for a moment, jaw set, eyes narrowed, and then said, "Well, what the hell, I'm already in trouble." He kicked down one of the sideslip thrusters, making the ship twist and dip dizzyingly. A Star Fury zoomed past, having completely failed to guess his vector, and a moment later it began spinning wildly as one of Dagger Disc's turret gunners relieved it of its portside thrusters. Smiling grimly, Corwin put the ship back on her outward vector. Only that one oddly shaped, unarmed, heavily shielded satellite stood between them and open space. "What are you going to do?" Utina wondered. "Ever had a thing you were never, ever, ever supposed to do, and suddenly found yourself in a situation where the only thing you could possibly do was that thing?" "Yes," she said. "I'm there right now. Take over." "What?" she exclaimed, but he was already up out of his seat. Utina shook her head and slid awkwardly across. He passed over her, or she under him, and they managed to trade stations without crashing the ship. "Just keep that yellow thing right in the middle," said Corwin, pointing to the nav indicator on the interdictor satellite as he squared himself behind the co-pilot's panel. "And when I tell you to cover your eyes, for God's sake, cover your eyes." Utina nodded, gripping the yoke and feeling the ship respond to her hands. It was kind of like driving, except with a greater feeling of speed. She oscillated back and forth across the mark for a moment, getting the feel and overcorrecting, but settled it quickly and kept the pipper right in the center. Corwin, for his part, was punching a long, complicated code into a numeric keypad surrounded by a flashing scarlet and white striped border, located on the left wing of his control console. The flashing got faster and faster, and then, with a loud beep, it popped up on a hinge and a joystick deployed from beneath it. Corwin took hold of this. A targeting reticule appeared in the center of the forward windows, surrounding the rapidly growing satellite. Utina felt the yoke go dead in her hands as Corwin said, "Reflex interlock engaged. Weapons officer spacecraft." As they rode the nav sensor beam in, Corwin made minute adjustments to the joystick he gripped, watching the reticule carefully until, with a final beep, it turned red and collapsed, strobing around the satellite. "Cover your eyes," he declared, and squeezed the trigger built into the joystick. Outside, the three functional Star Furies vectored in, guns blazing, on the suddenly straight and level enemy. Dagger Disc's aft dorsal shields pulsed and flared. One of them died with a brilliant explosion from the projector module, and the next spurt of fire burned a black scar on the silvery armor just after the cockpit neck. Still, the ship didn't respond, and the Earth Force pilots wondered if there was something wrong with the aggressor's helm. They were on a collision course with Barrier Sat 14. Suddenly, in the gap between the Corellian freighter's forward loading mandibles, yellow-orange lightning began flicking from one side to the other, growing in intensity and volume as the milliseconds passed until it filled the whole gap with an almost intolerable brightness. Had they had some kind of systems failure? Were they breaking up? An instant later, the whole forward quarter of the ship was obscured by a brilliant torrent of energy that poured forth as if from an open floodgate, streaking out to brush aside Barrier Sat 14's shields as though they weren't there, then spear the satellite like a bug on a plate. For a moment, holed completely through and still held on the beam, it remained steady. Then the beam flicked out as if a switch had been thrown, and Barrier Sat 14 drifted out of alignment, listed a bit to port, and exploded. Without time to dodge, Dagger Disc plunged into the fireball at top speed, debris and plasma sleeting off the forward shields, which fortunately weren't as battered as the aft ones. A bump, a heavy bang as some large piece of debris sheared off the dorsal comm dish, and they were clear. With the satellite's destruction and their rapidly growing distance from Earth, their gravitic influence gauges dropped immediately below the red line. "So long, suckers," Corwin snarled at the image of the pursuing Star Furies and their reinforcements in his rearview scanner. His brand glowed, his right hand danced over the auxiliary navicomputer controls without the help of his eyes, and then he seized the throttle quadrant, pulled it over to the right, and slammed it forward to the final stop. The stars outside the windows smeared into lines and exploded aft like sea spray, replaced by blazing blue-white chaos. Corwin released the controls, raised his fists above his head, and yelled, "Yes!" Exultant, not really thinking about it, Utena lunged across the cockpit, grabbed him up in her arms, and planted a good hard kiss on him. His eyes went momentarily wide with shock, then closed, and he'd about got his arms around her when she realized what she was doing and broke it off rather awkwardly. Sorry, she said with a sheepish, blushing kind of half-grin, rubbing the back of her neck with one hand. Got a little, carried away there. She looked down, at a loss, then said, "Hey, Kate, we should, go and see if everybody's okay back there, huh?" Rising to her feet, Utena added a bit clumsily, "Thanks for, everything, Corwin." "No problem," said Corwin in a quiet, absent tone. He waved abstractedly as Utena left the cockpit, then sat looking a bit blankly at the closed door. Caitlin rose and for a moment seemed as though she might say something. Then she sighed, patted Corwin on the shoulder, gave him a sympathetic look, and went aft as well. Corwin watched her go, then turned back to face the whirling jumble of hyperspace. "Sweet," said Nall, who had spent the entire incident immobile, silent, and watchful on his shoulder. "Your first kiss, huh, Rocket Boy?" "Shut up, Nall," said Corwin softly. Nall opened his mouth to retort, saw the look in Corwin's eyes as he gazed out at hyperspace, and then jumped down, looking a bit ashamed of himself. "Yeah," he murmured. I'll be in the back." Hyper footprint dissipated, Claire verified from the sensor panel. Dagger disk is away. Hyperspace vector analysis gives no greater than 40% confidence for any destination. "Of course not," Aya muttered. "Ben's smarter than that." "I was not aware you knew Captain Hutchins that familiarly," DePaul said from the turbolift doors. "We went out for ice cream once in 2394. Aya smiled nostalgically. "It was so sweet. We were attacked by ninjas." "Ninja, Admiral?" Even T'Pol couldn't hide a bit of disbelief at that. "Yeah, but it's okay," Aya smiled. "We outnumbered him 2 to 50. I still get invites now and again to their really big parties, and we bump elbows at Redneck's annual barbecue." T'Pol shook her head and decided to chalk up Aya's familiarity with Benjamin Hutchins as another unfathomable aspect of her commander. "In any case, why does Captain Hutchins..." "Admiral Hutchins," Aya chided T'Pol. "He commands the IPO fleet." T'Pol declined to play Vulcan pedant for Aya and point out that the IPO fleet consisted of one experimental starship and a Klingon battlecruiser that was perfectly capable of commanding itself. Instead, she continued, "Why does Admiral Hutchins' action hold any interest for you, aside from the academic? Our orders are complete, and our presence here is increasing tensions. Lieutenant Charos is fluttered with demands for this ship to stand down, and I notice Commander Lemno has turned off her comboard entirely. We are not welcome here."
I know, Aya waved off the points irritably. "But Admiral Hutchins has the rest of that kid Mackenzie's friends with him. I gotta get this group together again, and I'm trying to figure out where Ben would have taken them."
Logic dictates either the Admiral's residence on Zeta Cygni or his duty station on IPS Challenger at the Babylon Project worksite, T'Pol said.
Quiet, I'm thinking,
Aya grumbled, and T'Pol did not finish her statement, as the soon-to-be-commissioned Babylon 5 space station was less than 50 light-years from Earth. It seemed the most likely choice.
"Now let's see," Aya muttered to herself. "He folded in, but he didn't fold out. Why wouldn't he fold out?"
Logic would suggest that a reflex furnace, immediately following a reflex cannon discharge, cannot power a fold event, T'Pol replied.
I don't think you can count on that, Aya replied. This is Ben Hutchins's personal yacht we're talking about, a metal-flying guinea pig for a man who designs starships as a hobby. But prior knowledge of reflex over technology... To Paul, Aya sighed in exasperation, tell me again what the maximum speed Dagger Disc displayed was. Approximately 264 megalytes, T'Pol replied. What did CFMF Intel say its maximum sublight speed was supposed to be? According to latest reports, 100 megalytes, roughly equivalent to a T-65C starfighter in normal trim. And how fast can a Broadway-class Corvette go? With warp power diverted to the ion thrusters, T'Pol said, 90 megalytes. And you're going to tell me, after seeing Dagger Disc outrun concussion missiles, that Ben Hutchins couldn't have built in an improved reflex furnace we didn't know about either? Aya shouted. When in doubt, presume you don't know, Captain. And in this case, presume he could have folded when he wanted to. Now, Dagger Disc started on New Avalon. This we know, and this Earth Force also knows, and Ben has to realize that. So if he didn't fold out, it follows that he didn't want Earth Force tracking him back to New Avalon, because they'd presume he'd go back where he came from. No, Aya nodded decisively. He didn't go to New Avalon, and with Earth Force liable to chase him down, he's going to go someplace with plenty of backup. Bajor is close, and in addition to Challenger, it has Krontep's ship, the WDF starship's renowned and indefatigable, and two CFMF task forces guarding the construction site. More than a match for any Earth Force or Starfleet pickup force. Clear, open signal to fleet. Stand by for fleet orders. Then hail General Carlyle. I want to speak with him. Already have him, Claire smirked, clicking a few switches on the comm board. On screen. The bald head and florid face of General Carlyle filled the Charlemagne's flag bridge viewscreen. In one long, unbroken stream of words, he snapped, Admiral Ayami Nakajima, you will stand down your fleet immediately and prepare for boarding under Article 19 of the Constitution of the United Federation of Planets regarding the harboring of pirate... Ooh, General Carlyle! Aya bubbled, going into her cute act again. I was just about to call you. Guess what? We finally got our systems fixed again. Everything's A-OK here. We'll be going now. Bye-bye! Admiral, you will stand your fleet down now, or... In mid-threat, Carlyle vanished from the screen, to the giggles of both Claire and Aya, and the nervous twitching of T'Pol. All right, Aya declared, smiling. Flag to all ships. Prepare for metaspace. Destination Point Swampy. Repeat, Point Swampy. Radio silence next 15 minutes, effective immediately. Swiveling her chair to face T'Pol, she continued, Dagger Disc's hyperdrive is officially rated at factor 0.25, right? That is correct, T'Pol nodded. Assuming that is where they are headed, they should reach Bajor in about 84 minutes, approximately. Assuming, of course, that our intelligence regarding the ship's hyperdrive factor is accurate, which cannot be assumed, she added dryly. Aya chose to ignore her own logic, replying, Whereas we can reach it by metaspace in about 50 minutes. Let's get rolling, Captain. I want to shake Ben's hand for that rescue. The ship is yours, Captain. Admiral. T'Pol nodded, returning to the command deck. A minute later, moments before an Earth Force CC-6700 Coral-class interdiction cruiser could bring its gravity well projectors online, the 6th Carrier Task Force, CFMF Tactical Fleet, vanished into metaspace. And while recriminations began to circle among the various Earth Force and Starfleet generals and admirals, the captain of EAS Agamemnon smirked to himself and ordered his ship down from general quarters. Sometimes, John Sheridan thought to himself, Earth needed her nose tweaked. In the wardroom of Dagger Disc, the escapees made themselves as comfortable as they could and tried to catch their breath after the most eventful afternoon in recent memory. Devlin was stretched out on the couch, wrapped up in a blanket with the ship's registry number, name, and silhouette printed on it. Amanda knelt by his side, wiping the blood from his face with the cleaning paper from the medkit. Utna, Kate, Wakaba, and Sionji were sitting in the little booth, two on one side of the table, two on the other, giving each other worried looks. Professor Krolg had selected the center of the room in which to meditate. Tiny Robo and Lesser Mazinger were up on the booth table in sleep mode, allowing their depleted power systems to regenerate. Dorothy leaned against the bulkhead, examining her cat for injuries. Mia stood next to her, and Nall, up on his shoulder, was trying and failing to make conversation with the cat. It took all of them a few moments to remember that there was someone else in the wardroom with them, all the way on the other side, sitting curled on a packing case. They only noticed Liza Broadbank when they realized, one by one, that she was crying. Caitlin remained silent, but Wakaba at least tried to be sporting about it. She looked over and said, "It's okay now, Liza. You're safe."
"Safe?"
Liza replied bitterly, and Wakaba sighed at herself. Should have just let her snivel, at least then she wasn't being bitchy.
"Safe?" the blonde repeated. "The school is in ruins. Our grades for last term will never be posted. Our educations are all in chaos. And for what? One lousy blip. Why couldn't you just let them have him?"
Amanda looked up sharply, her good eye narrowing. "Tread carefully, human," she said in a low, dangerous voice. "My patience is at a very low ebb as it is."
"Don't threaten me," Liza flared. "This is your fault."
Amanda seemed genuinely taken aback. "How," she inquired coolly, "do you arrive at that remarkable conclusion?"
"If you and your idiot brother hadn't double-crossed your sister, she would never have told me about your teep boyfriend, and none of this would have happened,"
Liza snarled. Amanda, and indeed everyone else, stared at her in total incomprehension for a few seconds. Luckily, it clicked for Dorothy a second or so before it did for Amanda, and by the time the Gamelon had drawn her honor blade and lunged, the robot had handed her cat to Miki and interposed herself. Liza shrank back against the bulkhead, her voice strident with fear and desperation as she cried,
"Oh, sure! Kill me! That would make everything better! He was only in danger because you broke him out! If you had just left well enough alone, the Corps would have given him a home, a future!"
Wakaba could tell the blonde didn't actually believe what she was saying. She was just saying it because she needed to say something, to convince herself as much as anyone else that what she had done was right.
"Release me, android,"
Amanda snarled, straining in vain against Dorothy's ironclad embrace.
"I will kill her."
"Not today," Dorothy replied calmly. "So, Liza," Wakaba asked casually, "was the Corps going to give you a home in the future, too? I didn't know you were a telepath."
"I'm not," Liza insisted. "I don't know what they wanted from me. I don't have any genetic aberrations, any special powers."
"If you want my advice," said Dorothy, "you'll find somewhere else to be." She permitted Amanda to make about an eighth of an inch of headway and then deadpanned, "I won't hold her forever." Amanda tore herself away, composed herself, and sheathed her blade, all the time aiming a look of intense loathing at Liza. "You win, Dorothy. I'll spare her. She isn't my true enemy anyway." Her look of disdain deepened as she added caustically, "She was just another tool." Liza glared at her, then turned away with a sob and curled up on the packing case, facing away from all of them. With great, exaggerated dignity, Amanda turned and resumed tending to Devlin. Nall let out a breath he'd been holding.
"Thank the first egg," he murmured. "Dad would kill us if we got blood all over in here."